Well, thank you. Thank you, Lawrence. It is great to be back here, and thanks, as always, for Kangan News for the invitation to speak at this event. Every 6 weeks now, as Lawrence noted, the Monetary Policy Board meets to assess the state of the economy, think about its outlook, and then it sets monetary policy to achieve low and stable inflation and full employment. Now, it must judge the level of the cash rate that will deliver financial conditions that are consistent with those goals. Now, financial conditions are quite a broad concept. It captures, amongst other things, the availability of finance for households and businesses, as well as other financial influences on economic activity and inflation, such as the exchange rate and asset prices. Each of these elements are influenced by the cash rate and its expected path, and that's part of the standard monetary policy transmission process. And I think the stance of monetary policy, that's considered to be restrictive if financial conditions overall are assessed to be restraining demand, and alternatively assessed to be accommodative if financial conditions are assessed to be stimulating demand. But assessing overall financial conditions is challenging because they depend on a very broad range of factors, and each of those things can affect spending in the economy in very different ways. In addition, financial conditions affect demand with some lag, so that makes it hard to assess just how restrictive or accommodative monetary policy is in real time. Moreover, structural changes in the financial system and the economy more broadly mean that a given level of the cash rate can become more or less restrictive over time. And for all of these reasons, we use a range of different approaches to assess financial conditions and update our judgment on the overall stance of policy as new information comes to hand. An important part of the board's decision to raise the cash rate target in February of this year and March was an assessment that financial conditions in the second half of last year had been less restrictive than previously thought. This reassessment was based on evidence from, amongst other things, updated estimates of the neutral interest rate, together with direct measures of financial conditions such as strong credit growth and low risk premia in financial markets. So today I'm going to provide an update to a speech that I gave last October on Australian financial conditions. I'm going to outline a conceptual framework that and present a range of estimates and indicators that can help us to assess financial conditions and hence the stance of monetary policy. I'm going to step through how the RBA's judgment on these have evolved of late, and then finish with just a few words about the conflict in the Middle East. So let's start with the neutral rate. The cash rate plays a central role in determining borrowing and lending rates, but other things matter for financial conditions. And to assess the stance of monetary policy, we can compare the cash rate to the nominal neutral interest rate. Now, I like to think of this, and I said this last October, think of this as the conceptual cornerstone of an assessment of the stance of policy. It's conceptual because in practice, neutral rate estimates are very uncertain. And it's a cornerstone because it's merely the starting point on which to build other evidence. Two concepts of neutral are particularly relevant for my talk today. The first is quite familiar. It's a long-run concept of the nominal neutral rate, which is the cash rate that neither stimulates nor dampens demand once all shocks that are present and all structural forces have played out. And at that point, demand and potential supply in the economy will be in balance with full employment and inflation at target. So that's the definition of long-run neutral. The long-run neutral rate is also the rate at which global savings and investment are going to be in steady state. So it has a very much a global element to it. But a second and arguably more useful concept for monetary policy is what I'm going to describe as the short-run neutral rate. So that's the cash rate that's neither stimulatory nor contractionary over the next few years in the face of ongoing shocks and structural changes. So that short-run neutral rate is going to tend to be more variable, cycling around the long-run neutral rate. And the long-run neutral is also changing over time, but in response to slower-moving forces such as demographic change. Now, the shocks and the structural changes that can cause the two concepts to diverge can include changes in financial conditions, independent of the cash rate, and I'll talk through some of them later, via variation in, say, risk appetites in the private sector, or changes in fiscal policy, just to name two, and not just fiscal policy here, but importantly, fiscal policy globally. While some of these things can have quite persistent effects, monetary policy can still work to return the economy to full employment with inflation at target within about 2 to 3 years. All else equal, if inflation is elevated and likely to remain above the target for a time, as is currently the case, a restrictive stance of policy is needed for a time to slow the growth of aggregate demand and ease inflationary pressures. That is, the cash rate needs to spend some time above the level of the short-run neutral rate. Now, there's several ways to gauge the neutral rate. Many of them are model-based. I'm going to start, though, with just one that's quite readily available and on most of your screens, those who have access to market data. So market prices, and very specifically the overnight index swap rates, OIS rates, they provide a guide to how market participants expect the cash rate to evolve. OIS rates reflect collective judgments about the forces operating on the economy and the cash rate path that will satisfy the board's objectives. And while market participants face a range of uncertainty, the OIS curve still provides a guide to the stance of policy and, by extension, to the neutral rate. So if we look at this chart on OIS curves, during most of 2025, the OIS curve was downward sloping. And that suggested that market participants thought reductions in the cash rate would allow the board to meet its inflation and employment goals. Indeed, the board reduced the cash rate target 3 times between February and August. Later in 2025 and then into early 2026, however, the OIS curve, as you can see here, progressively shifted up, including around the 2 to 3 year point on the OIS curve. So this followed the accumulation of data pointing to stronger inflationary pressures than early expected. And the upward revision to expectations of the cash rate in a few years' time was consistent with the rise in market participants' perceptions of the short-run neutral. Now, if we could estimate the cash rate that will prevail when the economy reaches balance, we'd have a direct measure of the neutral rate. And that just follows from the definition of the neutral rate, namely that it's the cash rate that is neither restrictive nor stimulatory once the economy has reached a state of balance. One issue, though, is that the OIS curve contains time-varying term premia, so it doesn't provide a pure reading of future expected cash rates. To extract those expectations, we need to turn to models, although those models, and I've emphasised this before, are quite imprecise and they provide only a rough guide. So government bond yields, like the OIS rates, embed expectations of future cash rates, and they include term premia. But if we use a model, we can extract or try to extract the expected cash rate component from bond yields at different horizons. So this graph, the top panel, shows these four rates 3 years and then 10 years into the future. If we assume that market participants expect full employment and inflation in the middle of the 2 to 3% inflation target band in 3 years, then the expected cash rate at that horizon provides an approximation to the short-run neutral rate. And then the estimated cash rate in 10 years provides an approximation of the long-run neutral rate. There are two other classes of models that we use to infer neutral rates from economic outcomes. One class is a time-varying parameter vector autoregression, quite a mouthful, or just a VAR for short. This VAR model makes use of key macro variables without imposing very strong theoretical constraints. And the neutral rate is estimated cash rate projected to prevail well into the future using these models. And that's what's shown in the middle panel of this chart here, the central estimates from 3 different variations of that VAR model. And then finally, the other class of models we use are what I describe as semi-structural. So these use some economic theory to link the cash rate to measures of activity, spare capacity, and inflation. And the estimates of neutral in the bottom panel here are the far forward expected cash rates from three variants of that model. Now, if we put all of these together in this chart, which is a rather colourful spaghetti chart, I think the first thing that stands out is the various central estimates span quite a wide range. And that reflects, amongst other things, the imprecision with which we can estimate neutral. But each of these central estimates itself is estimated with some uncertainty. The other thing you can see over the sweep of time is that all the model estimates trended lower prior to the pandemic. And that appears to have affected the slower forces, moving forces such as population aging and declining productivity. And very similar trends were observed in many advanced economies, underscoring the global nature of neutral rates. And that was discussed and made clear by my colleague Penny Smith in November last year. But around that long-run trend, the neutral rate estimates from the semi-structural models, they've been relatively stable. And that's consistent with these capturing this long-run neutral rate concept. By contrast, the VAR estimates vary quite a bit more, suggesting they may be capturing factors that pick up more of the short-run neutral rate. And that's true also of the market model estimate at the three-year mark. Whereas the market estimate at the 10-year mark, not surprisingly, is more stable, and that's in line with it capturing the long-run neutral rate. The other thing you can see here is that over recent years, all the model estimates have picked up quite significantly, and that's something that's also been seen in other advanced economies. Now, there is a few plausible explanations for that rise in neutral that have been suggested, including government deficits across advanced economies that are absorbing savings, investment arising from the green transition and more recently the AI boom, and strong investor risk appetites leading to an easing in financial conditions. Turning to the stance of monetary policy, the cash rate, as you can see here, was above central estimates of the neutral rate between late 2023 and early 2025, suggesting a restrictive policy stance. But that assessment became less clear with a combination of the reductions in the cash rate target that occurred last year and further increases in the various model estimates of neutral, including because of revisions to some model estimates. So those models that are more likely to capture the short-run neutral rate, they've risen by about 10 to 30 basis points over recent quarters. But what about some direct measures of financial conditions? Given the limitations I've highlighted involved with neutral rate estimates, I think it is important to consider how elements of financial conditions have evolved more recently. Let me start with the exchange rate. As a small open economy, the value of the Australian dollar is an important element of financial conditions. And an appreciation of the dollar by itself lowers import prices, reduces export competitiveness, and thereby dampens activity and inflation. The appreciation of the Australian dollar over recent months has contributed to tighter financial conditions. But I think it's worth emphasising that appreciation has been in line with historical relationships with Australian interest rates relative to major advanced economies and also commodity prices, which have risen over this period. And we can see that because as shown in this chart, the trade-weighted index, the Australian TWI, is close to the equilibrium predicted by our model, which is based on those determinants that I just mentioned. In other words, the appreciation reflects normal transmission of monetary policy expectations rather than an additional tightening by itself. So cost-facing borrowers are a critical element of financial conditions, and households and business borrowing costs can be expressed, as shown here, as a spread over the cash rate. These spreads reflect bank funding costs, the assessment of borrower risk, and competition in deposit and loan markets, among other things, and all of those can vary over time, as suggested by this chart. Over the past 5 years or so, outstanding variable mortgage rates declined by about 1 percentage point relative to the cash rate, consistent with strong competition between lenders and favourable bank funding conditions. Business lending spreads also declined, though by a bit less. And all else equal, a persistent narrowing in spreads like this implies an easing in financial conditions and hence a rise in the neutral rate. The extent and speed with which those sorts of changes in lending spreads and other factors affecting financial conditions are captured by those earlier neutral rate estimates that I flagged, that's going to vary across the different models. So it's not surprising that market-based estimates, they should adjust pretty quickly, but that depends on market participants observing these changes and then accounting for them when they weigh up all the other determinants of the neutral rate. However, estimates from the macro models, they're going to take longer to account for changes in the cost and availability of finance, as shown here, since those sorts of things tend to affect the behaviour of macroeconomic variables only with some lag. The willingness and ability of households and firms to borrow and financial institutions to lend, that depends, in part, on whether financial conditions are restrictive or accommodative. And so, for that reason, credit growth itself can provide signals about financial conditions. Focusing on the past few years, total credit growth rose pretty strongly through 2021. And that was expected and intended outcome of the earlier very stimulatory monetary policy settings. Credit growth then declined for a time from late 2022 as policy was being tightened. Since 2023, though, credit growth rose again to well above its long-term average, reflecting both strong demand for and supply of credit. And because credit growth depends on other things, such as, you know, labour market conditions, just for one example, it's going to be unwise to ascribe all of the changes in credit growth just to the stance of monetary policy. But even so, I would argue that strong credit growth of late is an additional piece of evidence that financial conditions had not been particularly restrictive of late. Now, exactly the same sort of logic applies to generally strong economic data in recent months, including the CPI and the labour market. That is, these data also suggest the stance of policy over the second half of last year was not as restrictive as previously thought. Now, financial conditions indices, which are quite popular in some quarters, they can provide a rough cross-check on the stance of policy. Now, what is it that these do? Well, what they do is they distill quite a wide range of indicators related to the cost and availability of finance into one single index. And each of these FCIs has its own pros and cons, so I prefer to look at a range of estimates as in this chart. Together, though, what they show is a pattern that's broadly in line with what I think we would have expected around some key historical episodes like the global financial crisis and the onset of the pandemic. More recently, FCI suggests financial conditions became increasingly restrictive after the RBA tightened policy starting in 2022, but they appeared to have become a touch accommodative last year, reflecting, among other factors, the reduction in the cash rate and low risk premia across financial markets globally. While I would not place too much weight on FCIs, like the neutral rate estimates, they suggest that overall financial conditions are currently within the range of neutral. So to sum up, the Monetary Policy Board sets the cash rate to deliver financial conditions that are consistent with low and stable inflation and full employment. A key complication is that financial conditions can shift for reasons other than just the cash rate. And relatedly, the neutral cash rate can vary over time, and it's estimated with considerable uncertainty. Accordingly, the RBA staff present the board with a range of estimates of the neutral rate, as well as a range of measures, direct measures of financial conditions. And that broad range of evidence suggested that cash rate increases through 2022 and 23 had taken the stance of policy into restrictive territory. And by early 2025, based on the favourable outlook for the economic activity and inflation at the time, the board determined it was appropriate to reduce the restrictiveness somewhat. But from around September of 2025, the weight of evidence began to shift, suggesting financial conditions were no longer restrictive enough to return inflation to target in a reasonable time. And against that backdrop, and the broader signs of rising inflationary pressures, policy was tightened in February and March to help bring down inflation. So finally, just a few words on the effects of the conflict in the Middle East, in terms of its economic effects at least. The effects of the sharp reduction in the global supply of oil, natural gas, and other commodities, they're obviously apparent across financial markets. These changes and the heightened geopolitical and economic uncertainty globally have led to some tightening in financial conditions. Now, all else equal, that by itself implies a decline in short-run neutral rates here and offshore. That is, a tighter stance of monetary policy for a given cash rate. However, the supply shock also poses a risk to inflation and longer-term inflation expectations at a time when there are ongoing capacity pressures, not just in Australia, but several other advanced economies. This could push both short-run neutral rates higher and necessitate a more restrictive stance of policy. Indeed, financial market participants have revised up their expectations of monetary policy rates in Australia and most advanced economies. The increase in Australia just since the start of the conflict is shown in orange here, and that's been somewhat less than in other advanced economies. But it also came after that earlier increase shown in blue, which had reflected strong domestic data that was not seen elsewhere. Now, the longer the conflict persists, the larger the economic impact will be, and the greater risk of a material repricing of assets. A negative supply shock pushes up prices, leads to weaker economic activity, making us all poorer. And central banks can't change that. But they can ensure that initial price rise in prices does not lead to a rise in longer-term inflation expectations and extended inflationary pressures. We will continue to assess the countervailing forces operating on the economy here, including any tightening of financial conditions or increase in inflation expectations associated with the conflict, so the board can set monetary policy to achieve low and stable inflation and full employment over the medium term. So thanks for your time. I'm in Lawrence's hands to answer your questions.
Thanks very much. We've had a couple of questions come in, but we have got a few minutes. So if you want to ask any more, please send them through. First one is about what you were just referring to, the impact on inflation of the fuel crisis. The question is, what do you think the inflationary impact would be if the fuel price crisis becomes a fuel shortage?
Well, that's a case where, at least for some, the amount of fuel that they would like to get isn't available at any price. I think that's particularly problematic if it comes to pass. Not only does it mean the conflict has extended, potentially getting even worse than currently, but it also means that rather than just the shift in the supply curve, we're potentially going to get a shift, an adverse shift in demand. So that will add to weakness in the economy. At the same time, that means ultimately some less inflationary pressures down the track if demand is in fact shifting itself.
Thanks. A question asking if you have any thoughts on the most recent data prints, labour force, CPI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so last week we saw the labour force numbers come out and the unemployment rate shifted up a little in February. Employment grew though. Now our forecasts were had been back in February for a gradual increase in the unemployment rate on the back of an easing in the growth of demand. And then that easing in the growth of demand was underpinning our expectation of some easing in domestic inflationary pressures down the track, at least the domestic ones absent the war. No one knows how long the conflict in the Middle East will last though, what energy prices will do, and the extent to which those price pressures risk leading to inflation pressures more broadly via the so-called second round effects. So what we want to avoid at the bank is a rise in longer term inflation expectations that would come from that, that comes from oil price increases and other commodity price increases seeping into all prices across the economy.
Thanks very much. A couple of audience questions here that are going to, I suspect, veer dangerously close to no comment territory, but I'll ask them anyway. We'll see what we get. I'm going to do these in ascending order of how likely they are to be no comments. Would the RBA still need restrictive interest rates if the government institutes supply-side reforms?
Well, that's quite a hypothetical question. I'll do my best to give it a shot. I think it depends a bit on the nature of those reforms, but it's typical that supply-side reforms that enhance productivity, let's say, down the track, they take some time to play out, and they normally take more time than is available in the horizon that which monetary policy works over the next 2 to 3 years. So while anything that enhances the supply capacity of the economy and productivity growth is to be very welcome, because that's how we get real income growth, real wages growth, I'm not sure we'd have to see just what they were and whether or not they'd be relevant for monetary policy in the horizon over which monetary policy works.
Okay, and then the next one is, any thoughts on the threat to the Fed's independence?
No, I think the reality is that independence is very critical for central banks globally, and for the world, the independence of the Fed is critical. And any reduction in that independence ultimately will be reflected in financial market prices. And we saw some of that when various developments were occurring regarding some of the FOMC members, including Jay Powell. But look, I think I think that would be an undesirable thing to see, as most central bankers have said and would note. And it's not clear, though, whether that will come to pass.
Thanks. Let's do at least one more. This is a back in wheelhouse. How does the RBA actually measure inflation expectations?
Well, we look at lots of measures. So in my area, quite focused on market measures. You can look at inflation swaps. You can look at other measures from real bonds that are pay inflation compensation. But we also need to recognise what matters is not just inflation expectations held by market participants, but inflation expectations of households, workers and businesses. So we survey all of those, we look at those surveys and take some information from all of them.
Okay, let's try for one more. The RBA did not adjust rates that aggressively compared to other economies. That was obviously the last hiking cycle. Has this narrative changed? I mean, I guess this is a question about the narrow path, the so-called narrow path.
Yeah, so the board intentionally wanted to bring inflation down in a convincing fashion, but to do so in a way where at least there was the best chance of holding on to the gains in the labour market, which were outstanding gains post-pandemic here in Australia. So that was their strategy and approach. They've still said they would like to do that, but they're very much focused on inflation, given it is above target, and I don't think we're at full employment yet.
All right, well, look, I think there's a few seconds left, so let's squeeze this one in because it's a natural progression. Is the RBA willing to force recession to bring balance in the economy?
I don't think that's in the, if you go off what Michelle had said earlier, that's not the intention. Again, the intention is to try and hold on to those gains in employment where possible, so long as inflation is on a credible path down and inflation expectations don't get out of hand. But that wouldn't be the expectation or the approach, I would imagine.
Okay, great. Look, we're back on time, so I'm sure everyone will want to join me in thanking Chris Kent. Thank you very much for coming back.
See you next week. Pleasure. Thanks, Lawrence.